Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it really is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Horia Muzadik. Horia's life started with war. She was born in 1973, just a few years before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which triggered the decades of conflict that have gripped her home country ever since. She is now an Afghanistan researcher with Amnesty International, and in 2015 was awarded the Afghanistan Seamurg Human Rights Award by the Armin Shah Foundation, which is an annual prize given to a human rights defender who has done exceptional work. Horia has many memories from the 1980s when Afghanistan descended into chaos, most of them bad. She saw her father pay off Mujahideen commanders simply so they wouldn't harm his children because they were going to school. He quit his government job, unable to continue working for a regime that so flagrantly violated human rights. Her male classmates were forced into the military from the age of 16. The war killed students, teachers, civil servants, and ordinary Afghans. In school, she started speaking out against the policies of the Russian-backed government, until one of her teachers took her aside to tell her that her opinions could cost her her education, freedom, or worse. In 1993, her worst nightmare came true when a rocket hit her home and killed her brother. When the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan in 1996, they were welcomed by many war-weary Afghans who wanted nothing but stability and peace. Instead, even more repression followed. Once, Horia was severely beaten by one of the Taliban's vice and virtue police officers simply for lifting her burqa to look at a piece of fabric. She fled to Pakistan in 1995, where she worked as a journalist for an international news agency, filing numerous reports about the atrocities the Taliban and other armed groups were committing. After the US-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, that toppled the Taliban, she returned to the country and led a human rights organisation. Despite the countless threats she has received, she has never given up her struggle to tell the truth. Horia also established the first war victims network in Afghanistan, giving survivors a chance to tell their stories in local media and organise demonstrations to call for truth and justice. Thank you so much for giving your time to being interviewed. When I was putting together, doing research on you and putting together the words to introduce you, I've interviewed many, many women since I've been doing, and some amazing women. Yeah. I don't think I have ever been so moved and so humbled as when I was doing the research on you and putting together the background information.
Thank you.
On you. What a truly amazing woman you are. And I was talking to somebody recently and saying how privileged I recognize I am to be born in the West.
Yeah.
At a time where I haven't witnessed war. I can remember growing up in the 70s when we were being bombed by the IRA in London. That was just something we but never the direct experience that so many people around the world are facing every single day. Absolutely incredible. I don't quite know where to start. This interview. I mean, there's so much I would love to ask you. I have a feeling 50 minutes isn't going to be long enough.
Let's see.
Let's see. And we might have to, this might be part one, and we might have to come back for part two. How have you managed to keep your grace and dignity with your life experience?
Well, I think, you know, what happens really when you when you witness, when you experience violence at so many levels of your life, I think it may have two impacts on you.
Mm.
Whether it will turn you into another perpetrator,
right?
To take a gun, go and kill, or and take revenge, or it may turn you into someone who would say, like, because I suffered, and because I have seen many others suffered, I wouldn't want anyone else to suffer anymore.
Yeah.
And I need to stop that suffering with whatever means I can.
Mm.
But of course, through a non-violent way and through a way that you can set a good example for others.
Mm. Mm.
And I think this is what I have chosen to do. And this is what I'm going to do. And I will not give up.
Mm.
Mm. And of course, like many people, they also say that I'm very brave, you know. And being brave also, it doesn't mean that I have never been scared in my life.
Of course.
There were times that I felt the fear inside my bones. There were times that I felt the fear, under my skin. And I had a cold sweat.
Yeah.
But from the other hand, I didn't want to show that side to the people who I was fighting for.
That is an incredible balance to achieve, isn't it? I mean, as you say, it can either turn you, the experience of war can either turn you into a perpetrator, or it can turn you into fighting against it. It can also paralyze you with fear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I should think is a lot of people's experience. They may have the desire and the fire in their belly to do what you do, but fear is the overriding and dominant emotion, and it stops them in their tracks and prevents them from doing what their heart wants to do. How did you, and how do you continue to push through that fear?
Well, I think this is exactly what I think. I think one of the very effective methods that perpetrators are using to spread fear and make you to scare, and they would not know any limit. They can go to any limit, from harassing, threatening, to attacking you, your family members, and anyone that you're very close to. That, like, for example, you know, there was a shooting against my husband, and they shooted several bullets at his car. Luckily, he escaped safe. Two bullets struck to his car while he was driving. Even he didn't know that there was a shooting to him. He said suddenly he heard some really like buzzing noises, and a tack tack to his car. And he said, I didn't realize till he just saw, you know, like the back window was broken. And then, you know, he had to speed off, and then he stopped by a police check post. Then he saw two bullets struck his car. One went under the seat, it hit the door, and it went under the driver's seat, and another one hit the back window.
Good grief.
And there were attempts to kidnap my children. I think what the methods they were using, they have seen that I'm not giving up.
Yeah.
And then they diverted their attention to my loved ones,
yeah,
to the people that they were my weakness. Mm,
of course, yeah.
You know, and this was the time that, you know, I was really thinking to myself that this is my war. This is not my children's war.
Mm.
And am I going to sacrifice them?
Mm.
Am I going to lose them? But, you know, all the time, one thing that it constantly came to me, and it's still coming, is, shall I let them win? Shall I let them to a kind of overwhelm me, or somehow like to defeat me by what they are doing? Like, you know, a few months ago when I was in Kabul, I was followed by a car, and I just noticed that in the coming few days. And then I contacted few trusted contacts within the security forces. I told them that I have noticed a pattern of different vehicles following me around, and they informed me that it wasn't their people, because sometimes they may do right. to find out who okay. you are, okay. what you do. Like, right. especially if you know, if they know who you are, they may follow you to find out if you're, you know, what you're doing, who you're yeah. meeting. But then I was told that it wasn't government. So
right.
then definitely there were some other people yeah. who are still having an interest.
Absolutely.
And they want to know what I'm doing and what I'm involved in. So, but with all that, I think, and also what I have seen incredibly that gave me the strength and gave me the power was also the support of my husband and, mm. and my children, you know. So many times, my mother, she just cried and she said that, I have lost a child and I don't want to lose you.
Mm.
Can you please stop? You know, and I told her, like, you know, for me, my mission is not to stop.
Mm.
You know, and I told her that, you know, maybe there will be a time that you will lose me, but you have to be prepared for that.
That's a tough conversation to have with your mother.
Yep. I told her, you know, there were people who lost the entire family and their lives went in vain. And there wasn't even anyone survived to take the legacy of that family mm. forward.
Mm.
And I will not give up.
Is your mother in Afghanistan?
Yes.
And your husband and children?
My husband and children are here.
They're in the UK. Yeah. Okay.
So, and then, like, you know, of course, it was very heartbreaking moment for her, and she was very, very sad, and she was very emotional about that. But at the same time, you know, I think this is the truth. I could be killed in a car accident.
Well, this is very true. There is no guarantee. You know, I have a very, in inverted commas, normal life. You know, I travel quite a bit, but I don't travel to war zones. But you're right, something could happen in the plane, something. I could just step out of my home and cross the road and something. Yeah. You know, so we don't know, do we? When our time's up, our time's up.
Exactly.
And it's about, for me, doing what I can with every second that I've got. That means something. I mean, no way, even remotely on the scale that you're doing. But, you know, in our own way, we all, most people will do
yeah,
that.
Absolutely.
And there are some people, it was interesting. I'm digressing slightly, but not very much. I, with some of the training that I do, I talk about how the brain thinks and the four quarters of the brain. And where leadership sits, of course, it sits in all four quarters, but there's one particular quarter, which is the bottom right quarter of the brain, which is very collaborative. And a lot of people in business will assume that people in that quarter don't make good leaders because they're too weak and they will get stepped on and walked over because they're gentle. I said, okay, that's really interesting, because actually that's where Nelson Mandela sat.
Yeah.
That's where Mother Teresa sat. That's where Gandhi sat. Never, ever underestimate gentleness. It is far more powerful than aggression.
Absolutely.
And they are the true leaders. And they are the leaders that people will follow because they are role models. They won't follow out of fear. And that's where I would put you. So somebody, so do you think that what you do is the reason you were born?
I think so, yeah. You know, I truly believe, you know, like, I think, you know, there are people that were, like, all of us, we are all born for a reason.
Yeah.
Insects, plants, trees, everything have been created for a reason.
Absolutely.
You can't find a single thing in this world that was created for no reason.
That's
so this is why I believe that maybe the reason that I was born to be someone to set an example of non-violent struggle for reaching to justice, and someone who can give voices to the people who are voiceless, who don't know how to speak out, simply whether because they are scared or they don't want to or they are in denial.
Yeah. But to continue with that, when you have the other emotional triggers, you know, of your mum, which is very, very difficult and an absolutely understandable thing for her to say to her daughter. You know, you absolutely understand why she had that conversation.
Absolutely.
And then when your husband and children, you know, they know which buttons to push, don't they? To get you to potentially back off and change your mind.
Yeah.
Have you seen a difference since you started doing the work that you're doing? Have you seen anything change?
In
Afghanistan?
A lot, yeah. I think, you know, like going back to when you mentioned about my husband and my children, like my youngest daughter, she's just 10 years old. Last year when I was going to Afghanistan, she just came to me and she said, "Mom, if I ask you, don't go, will you listen to me?" And I said, "Why?" She said, "I'm scared that you will get killed." I think she overheard me in a conversation I had with my husband. And I said, "No, I don't think I will be killed. Why should I be killed?" She said, "Well, because I think there are bad people there who may kill you." And I said, "There might be, but I know that God will protect me." And she said, "Why are you so confident about it?"
Oh, wow. That's quite a question for a 10-year-old.
It was, absolutely. And I said, "Because God knows that I haven't done anything bad to anyone, and I'm not doing anything to harm anyone." And then she looked at me and she said, "Many women, children, and men around this world, they haven't done anything bad to anyone, but they are getting killed on a daily basis."
Fair point.
Yeah, and she said, don't have that much trust to God. He's always full of surprises.
Oh, wow!
And
that's quite a daughter you got there.
It was absolutely, and I was totally shocked listening to
her. Goodness gracious me.
It was, and then I told her that, "Listen, you know, I don't want to be harsh with you, but even if I get killed, at least I will give you an opportunity to walk with your head up."
Okay.
"So at least you can tell your friends, the people of your own generation, that even if your mother has died, she died for a cause. You know, she didn't die as someone who is watching."
As somebody who's doing.
I said, "This is what you can tell, and this is what will maybe make you to feel that even you lost a mother, but you lost a mother for a cause, not for nothing. And also, at least when I die, what I really think with myself, that, you know, I will die with a clear conscience, because I wasn't watching. I was trying to do things, and I was trying to improve it." And she felt tearful, and she just hugged me and said, I don't want my mommy to die."
Oh, of course. How you deal with those conversations and to continue to get on the plane and go. I mean, the pull on your heartstrings, I can't even begin to imagine.
Like, yeah, most of the times, you know, you have to hold your emotions back. You have to show them your strong side. Like, even, you know, sometimes even when I think, it makes me tearful when I'm with myself.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, I don't want to show them that side.
And I suppose part of it as well, if you kind of equate you very loosely to Martin Luther King. You know who, because actually I think what you what you're doing and what you're enrolled in is along the same lines. And if you think of the legacy of what he created and the legacy that he left, which is still there today, it's, you know, some people are almost not like human beings. Some people are born, I mean, this may sound a bit woo-woo and what I'm trying to say is that, you know, most people are just human beings, and we arrive and we go through our day to day and we do what we need to do, and then we die and we pop off, and we make an impression, hopefully most of it good. Most people will do their best. There are some people, it's almost as though they are on a completely different level to the rest of humanity, and they didn't arrive, they were sent. And I think Martin Luther King was sent.
Absolutely.
Nelson Mandela was sent. Yeah, Mother Teresa was sent.
Yeah.
Gandhi was sent.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's other people around the world who didn't arrive by some mistake.
Yeah, they, by accident.
By accident or coincidence.
Yeah.
They were sent.
Yeah.
So you are one of the people.
Oh, thank you.
That were sent.
Thank
because,
you.
Because we all want to make our dent on the universe. You know, we all want to create our own ripples as we go through life. But some of those ripples are going to be wider and deeper than others. This is going to be potentially a controversial question. If you were to die before your time was up, so far too early, you would no longer be able to do the work that you're doing.
Yeah.
Is there a way you could do the work that you're doing without putting your life at risk, so you can potentially do it for longer?
Yeah, well, you know, like, I truly believe that, you know, like what you said about, you know, human being, I think we are all created, whether Adam or Eva. But out of all Adam and Eva, some people make to become a human.
Okay.
And some people never make it.
True.
This is why you have so many levels of violence and injustice around the world going on. Because they could never become a human being, and they never qualify to become a human being.
So what are they then?
I think they are just a bunch of savages who are just created as, you know, like in a body of a human, but in their heart and their mind, they are even, I think for some of them, it's an insult to call them animals.
Well, animals very rarely behave to the level that a lot of human beings do.
Absolutely, yeah. This is why I'm always very cautious even to use the word animal for them. And this is why, you know, I think this is when the challenge comes. This is when we think about, you know, whether we take those challenges, whether we risk our life or not. Sometimes if you have a beast in front of you, and you know that if you don't stop that beast, even for the cost of your life, they will go and harm a bigger population.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to put yourself forward.
Well, you don't have to, but some people choose to.
Yes.
And you're one of the people that has chosen to.
You know, like, otherwise, you know, and then, you know, if you just run away and you think that, okay, I will hide and the beast will not find me, let them to eat or harm or do whatever to other people, I think down the line you will live with extreme troubling conscience.
And guilt.
And guilt, because you could have stopped and you didn't, and you allowed that to happen.
So what I mean, such an interesting theory that there are certain human beings on the planet who actually aren't human beings at all. You know, they haven't fully evolved as you or I and the majority of people have. Do you believe there is hope for a different world in the future?
Definitely there is. You know, I'm one of those people who always remain extremely hopeful. And I am always saying, if there wasn't any hope for the future, I would have given up. Yeah. I would never want to waste my energy and my time for something that there is no future for it. I think there is a need for a global evolution of human being.
Yeah.
We need to encourage everyone around the world to think about coexistence, mm-hmm. about tolerance, and stop our governments from creating all these wars around the world, from arming different people because they have an armed factory and they need to sell and get money. And for selling that, they need wars. We need to stop our governments, you know, from around the world, whether it is Saudi, whether it's Iran, whether it's USA, whether it's UK, Sweden, I don't know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere. And the people have the power. And we, in our language, we say people's power is God's power.
Right.
But we never use that power. Mm. And this is because the majority of us are cowards. We are watching.
True.
We are not doing anything. True. And we are saying, okay, let that person to do the job. If he or she succeeds, that's fine, we can benefit. If they fail, nothing will harm us because we are.
Yeah. But with the people who instigate war, and if we pick up the government and put them to one side for the moment, and let's assume in a parallel universe we are living in a world where governments are not creating war for profit. So let's just assume that's where we're living, and that's happening.
Yeah.
It's our reality.
Yeah.
How do you then deal with the people who still exist, who still want conflict, even if the governments around the world are not promoting it, are not encouraging it, and are not supplying them with the weapons, but the need for conflict still exists in the heart and minds of certain people?
It does.
How do you tackle that?
Well, I think it definitely does. Even if you look from the beginning, from the Stonehenge, from the, you know, Copper Age, or, you know, Bronze Age, until now, you know, like all the time you have seen that there is something in many people's heart, the greed for blood, greed for power, greed for expansion. And, you know, and it led, and even on that time, there wasn't these weapon-making factories.
Absolutely not.
There wasn't.
And no governments.
No governments, absolutely. But then they have created, and I think this is why, you know, if you look at the human creation, you always have a devil force and you have angels forces.
Yeah.
And regardless of how powerful the devil forces are, at the end, the angels are winning and they are the winners. So I...
True.
Like, looking at that True. Classic theory. But, you know, I truly believe, you know, that if we live long enough and teach our new generations, our generations to come, about nonviolent behaviors and about, you know, satisfaction within, I think people who have greed for blood, for violence, for expansion, for power, you don't have satisfaction within.
I would love to believe that you're right.
You know, and this is, I think this is what you have to go and search it in other things. Some people do it by having so much money and wealth, and still you're not satisfied.
Yeah.
And you would go for more.
Yeah.
Some people do it with power. Some people would do it with other means, even collectors. You know, like deep collect and collect and still you're not satisfied with that.
So it's a constant searching of the soul, isn't it? The soul is searching for something, and people don't know what it is that they're searching for, so they try and create it with material things.
Absolutely.
And of course, that's absolutely. But however, I absolutely agree with you, and I think that's where most people would want to see the planet and how we behave on the planet. And you will see conflict within peace. You know, does peace actually exist? Because in theory, the UK is a peaceful nation, in theory. But of course we're not. The US is in theory a peaceful nation, but of course it isn't. There is no country in the world that is truly at peace, because you have conflict on your front door.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you see people with road rage. When culture, religion, politics has absolutely nothing to do with it.
Absolutely.
But, you know, if you cut somebody up in the car, somebody's going to, you know, and I've seen it happen. So you see conflicts happening in a blink of an eye. We're surrounded by it. So is there any nation on this planet that is truly at peace when conflict can happen in a nanosecond? How do we get everybody on the planet to truly be peaceful?
Well, I think, you know, to be honest, this is not possible to have everyone to be peaceful. And I totally agree with you. Whenever we speak about peace and war, I think it depends how you define peace.
Yeah.
For me, peace is when I sleep in the night, I know that even with my door open, no one will enter and, you know.
So it's the definition
intrude.
Of the word.
You know, like, I can sleep with a peace of mind. I can walk with a peace of mind.
Right.
When I send my children to school, I should have that calmness inside me that nothing will happen to them.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you. And I don't think that will be possible in the long term. But the only thing is that we can stop, or at least minimize, the level of the violence that are happening around us.
Which is different to creating peace, isn't it?
Exactly. And this is making our life even more difficult.
Yeah.
And regardless of where we live.
Yeah.
And we need to encourage, especially the young generation, you know, how to be satisfied within.
Yeah.
How to search for peace within.
Yes.
And if you don't do that, it will be extremely difficult. It will be extremely difficult to reach, because you don't have peace of mind, because you don't have peace within. This is why you expose or expert violence to others.
It's that peace within your soul, isn't it? Within the very depths of your soul.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which some people do manage to attain. And some people have glimpses of it, and other people are able to hang on to it.
Yeah.
And some people, sadly, I think, go through life in their own torment.
Absolutely.
And their own inner torture, and they never find it.
No, exactly.
And they have that own, they may not have external conflicts, but they go through life with an internal conflict.
It is, absolutely. And I think everything happens when you're in search of something and you can't find it.
Mm.
For many people, even they don't know what they are searching for, what they are looking for.
Mm.
Like, maybe it's money, they have the money, but still the peace is not there.
Mm.
Maybe it's car, maybe it's house, maybe it's children, maybe it's beautiful woman or beautiful husband, maybe education. You know, and you have to keep digging and digging and digging.
Striving for something.
Absolutely. And I think it is really important that you reach to the point that you're satisfied and you know what you're searching and looking for and hang on to.
So what are you searching and looking for?
Justice.
Justice.
And I will continue till I reach.
You will. I hope that, I have no doubt. So when you go to Afghanistan, so your work with Amnesty International, it says you're an Afghanistan researcher. What does that actually mean? What does your role entail?
Yeah, This rule is mainly involved investigating human rights violations.
Okay.
And this rule also is involved quite a lot of lobbying meetings and advocacy with the government and non-government officials, with the UN, with the, you know, like, also diplomatic agencies and non-government organizations and, you know, maybe elders, maybe, you know, different people at different levels. So, and it also requires a lot of traveling. Like sometimes you have to go and visit extremely difficult situation, and you have to, like, I meet someone who lost 5 members of the family killed in front of their eyes. And they're telling you their story with the extreme trauma that they have gone through, and you can see still they are traumatized from what have happened. And you're visiting a village or a mosque that was bombed, and people who describe you how they're pulling bodies and everything, you know. And at the same time, you know, doing all that, so there are always people who are happy when you're doing it, and there are always people who are unhappy about what you're doing. It depends, you know, who committed the crime.
And, sure, yeah.
And once you release your report, who will be upset from that? And doing all that, I think one thing that makes me always happy, and it gives me that sense of satisfaction, that when I tell them, and they're asking me, what do you do with this information? And I'm saying, like, for example, I would share it with the Afghan government, I would share it with the US government, I would raise your voice to the Taliban, and I would do this, and let's hope there is a, you know, there is a solution for that. Maybe, you know, Taliban didn't think twice before attacking a civilian area. Maybe US forces think twice before dropping a bomb somewhere. Maybe Afghan government thinks twice before arresting and torturing someone. So everything happens for a long-term goal that may bring those changes to them.
And what changes have you seen?
Well, I think a lot of changes, a lot of changes. I think in the past at least 15 years since I have been involved directly with all human rights work, for example, now, despite the torture is happening in Afghan prisons, but the level is so decreased, because in the past it was happening systematically.
Right.
And across the board, regardless of your age, crime, and whatever. The first thing was you would be beaten, tortured, and then a confession by force, and then you would be sent to court. So at least those methods has changed. And now, like, still there is use of torture, but not to the extent that it used to be. And many interrogators and police investigators, they will think twice before, you know, using torture. And for example, in terms of the laws, there have been so many laws have came to Afghanistan, and many of those laws are clearly guaranteeing the right of people, and especially like elimination of violence against women law, which is tackling, you know, certain acts of violence against women and criminalizing it, which wasn't a crime in the past.
When did that come into force?
In 2009.
And it's having a positive impact,
it? It is having a positive impact. Like, it is not able to tackle the extent of the violence that happens around the country, but still it is having an impact, and you're seeing it. And, for example, freedom of expression, you know, despite there have been so many issues and problems, but you will not be a kind of killed or arrested by the government if you speak out.
Right.
And if you criticize, you know, the government. There have been quite a lot of positive changes that happened in the past 15 years, which I am extremely happy that, you know, I think down the line in, I don't know, maybe in another 10, 20 years, we may have a different Afghanistan if there wasn't war.
What would you like to see happen in the next decade?
Well, I think the first thing for me is just to have rule of law in the country.
Right.
Just to see no one is standing above the law in the country.
Mm.
And by saying that, you know, for me, the first priority for having the rule of law is to remove all these perpetrators who are suspect of committing massive human rights violations from the power. Because they are the blockades to the implementation of any law in the country.
Mm.
And, you know, by dealing with them and removing them, you will be able to pave the way. And also you can set an example that you cannot get away with the crimes that you have committed.
Do you think that will happen realistically? Do you see that happening?
I'm quite hopeful. I don't know. It may happen. It may not happen in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a struggle that I will continue. And this is what I will keep asking. And so this is why they don't like me.
You're like a little mosquito, aren't you, that comes along and bites them every now and again.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And even by boozing, you know, their sleep, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
By boozing, I can just take away their peace, you know.
Yeah, good for you. You keep buzzing. To date, what has been your greatest achievement, do you think?
Well, I think there were some. I think, let's start from my own husband's family.
Mm.
Like, before I was married, in their family, birth of a daughter or a girl was not celebrated much.
Ah, it's all about the son.
Everything was about having a son. But I changed that perception. I changed that perception that now, like, not only people are, like, they are happy when they are having a girl, but they are celebrating it and they welcome it.
Good.
And they are, they take it as a very, a kind of goodwill from God by giving them a daughter.
Fantastic.
So, and by saying that, like, then if you look at the wider picture, I think in the past 15 years, I think I have been part of the constitutional drafting process and approval process. And I was one of the ones who were buzzing and pushing and pushing. Even on that time, we didn't have a strong civil society in Afghanistan to at least have equal rights for both men and women, mentioned in brackets, men and women, because when you say all citizens are equal, it means, you know, all men.
Yeah.
So no, put it in brackets and say men and women, so people know. And there have been a number of other laws and reforms that happened in the country that I was part of, that forces that were pushed for the changes. And more importantly, I think the work that I started on transitional justice and by talking about the past human rights violations and crimes was something that no one was daring even to speak on that time. But now I'm seeing that here and there people are talking about it, and there are groups and organizations that have been created. And, you know, it gives me an absolute pleasure. And even some of my you know, friends and colleagues back in Afghanistan, they're calling me the mother of transitional justice of Afghanistan.
Are they? That's a great title.
So,
mother of transitional justice, wow.
So this is like when you see like these changes are happening, you know, this is quite great. And more importantly, like back in 2012, I did a research with Amnesty International on the situation of internally displaced people, and it was because everyone was talking about civilian casualties, but no one was looking into the other impact of the conflict, which was displacement, loss of livelihoods, loss of your safety net. And when we launched that report to Afghanistan, of course it upset the government a lot, but at the same time, within a year, the government drafted and launched an IDP's national policy. So they came to some sort of a kind of durable solution how to tackle the issue of displacement. And then the discussion of how they can minimize displacement of civil populations during military operations. Mm-hmm. You know, we raised that at the highest level with the US, with the NATO, with Afghan government forces. And this is something that now they are taking into consideration. Like, it is not about civilian population don't get killed, but also make sure they are not also displaced.
Yeah.
Or even if they are displaced, there need to be enough a kind of measures in place to protect
them. There's got to be a strategy in place, isn't there, to deal with them.
And like that, like I can give you a few other examples, but at least.
So for your children, have you got girls?
Yeah, I have three girls.
Three girls?
Yeah.
And one's 10?
One's 10, one is 16, and another is 21.
Wow. Wow. So what would you like their future to be? And where would you like it to be, here or Afghanistan?
I think this is something that they can choose for themselves, where they want to go and where they want to work. But I think what is really important for me is, and this is what I and my husband, we keep telling them, that I don't care what profession you choose, how much salary you will get, what kind of lifestyle you will have. But whatever you do, you should look at two things. One is, do not harm.
Do not harm.
And second, think what you can give back.
Mm.
Whether it's the UK society, which gave you the opportunity to study and to have a life free of violence and harassment and many issues that many young women in Afghanistan are facing, or whether it could be the Afghan society. But you should seriously think about how you want to give back, how you want to pay back. And if you don't pay back, it will be some sort of treasure or treason.
Wow, that's a powerful statement for a parent to give to their children. How did they respond to that?
Well, I think they understand that. And my eldest daughter, she's in the uni, she's studying psychology and English literature. So she says that when she finishes, she wants to do clinical psychology, and she really hopes to go back to Afghanistan and other conflict countries and to provide psychosocial therapy to the victims of trauma and conflict. So, this is what you can do, you know, and I think it is always important for them to think about, wherever they will stand. It is because of some people in this society who gave them that opportunity, so they could have reached to that. Whether it was the sacrification of your mothers and grandmothers, or if it was for the sake of someone else, but they have to think about how they can pay it back.
So in the final 60 seconds, which I can't believe, 50 minutes has gone in like five, from the Western perspective, so me as a Western white woman who is hugely ignorant about conflict around the world, what is really happening. I only know what I'm fed by the media and the bit of research that I do. What, and as a result of that, feel fairly impotent and ineffective to make any change. In a few words, what can people in the West do that's positive for the future of the whole planet?
Hold their governments accountable.
Ah.
Don't let them to play with the lives of other people around the world. Mm. I still remember how David Cameron took all these weapon traders with him to Libya, even before Gaddafi was toppled. I remember they have been talking about arming Syrian Liberation Army, which later on turned that they were Daesh and people who would behead and who would eat human organs. And I think people in the West have much, much better and strong voices to tell their governments, for removing a dictator, you don't need to go after another dictator.
Fair point. Okay. We're going to have to leave it there. We could talk for a long, long time. So people in the West, listen to what she has to say. Stand up to our governments and don't let them get away with stuff. This has been Katie Day, and you've been listening to Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous, and nobody sums up those words better than you do, Hore. In fact, we just rock.
We do.
We do indeed.